You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
David Masumoto may be the award-winning author of six books, but first and foremost, he's an organic farmer who grows heirloom peaches, nectarines, grapes, and raisins, just like his father before him on his 80-acre farm 20 miles south of Fresno, California. In his latest book, Wisdom of the Last Farmer, Harvesting Legacies from the Land, he writes about his farming family, the difficulties of growing his flavorful peaches, and of his love of the land. It's published by Free Press, and I'm pleased that it has brought Masumoto to my show today. Welcome.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here and share some stories.
Your family has been in farming for a long time, but didn't you consider leaving the farm to work elsewhere?
Oh, absolutely. Like a lot of farm kids, the first thing you want to do is run off and go over the hill and see what's on the other side. So I left, and I ended up going to UC Berkeley for my undergraduate work.
Sociology.
Absolutely, because I figured that would never take me back to the farm. And my parents, of course, in that day, and it was in the early 70s, they never wanted to come visit me, and they never did. So in one sense, it worked. But while I was at Berkeley, I decided to be an exchange student, went to Japan, lived there for 2 years, ended up working in this little rice village that my grandparents had immigrated from, and that probably was the turning point when I realized I have this affinity with agriculture.
But you didn't wind up growing rice.
No. Well, interesting, too, that I realized rice is an alien crop to me. Here I was, Japanese American. We ate rice all the time. I didn't know how to grow it. I didn't know how to transplant it. But I did know peaches, nectarines, and grapes. So that's another thing that pulled me back.
The book is largely about your relationship with your father. Is he the last farmer you're referring to in your title?
Certainly. When he was farming and when I left the farm, and along with my brother and sister, he thought he would be the last farmer. And he started making some changes on the land, knowing that he wouldn't have that longevity with it. When I came back, I started farming with him, and I realized I need to learn a lot from him. And in that sense, he still was the last farmer until I became the farmer. And so maybe there was a thought that I would be the last farmer, too.
Well, you said you had a lot to learn from him, but he didn't talk much. So how did you learn from him?
He was this very quiet, reserved, stoic farmer, and it took time. I remember when I first came back, I'd had to have the lunches, continuous lunches, for 20 days straight to get one full story about the dynamite he used on our farm to clear it.
Now, why do you think he was so stoic? Is it because that's the way farmers are often, or is it because of the circumstances of his life, because of the Japanese internment and all of those other things?
I think it's a combination of both. On the one hand, a lighter side is, who do you talk to in the farm? Your peach trees and grapevines? They don't talk back. But on the other hand, I think because of being Japanese American, our family was interned and lost everything during World War II because they were Japanese and looked like the enemy. I think he developed certain patterns of behavior where his story wasn't welcomed anywhere.
How was he able to buy the farm after he'd lost everything?
When he came back to the farm, we rented land for a couple years, and he said he took the biggest gamble in his life, put a down payment on some land. And interestingly, my grandmother and grandfather were both still alive then. My grandmother told him, you made a huge mistake because in America, they take things away from you. And my dad said, but this is America where you buy land and make your name. So that was the dichotomy of how our farm began.
Well, this is really the story of three generations in America as well, and changes in America, but also changes in a family. I understand why your grandfather would have felt that way under the circumstances. But also other kinds of changes. You decided to seek out organic certification for the farm, and your father wasn't sure that that was a good idea.
Well, at that point, this was in the mid-'80s, no one was farming organically, and his concern was, okay, you raise this organically, we're going to have all these new problems, all these weeds that I've spent my lifetime getting rid of are going to come back to the farm. And I said, yeah, that's part of organic farming. But even more so, he said, who's going to buy this? Because at that point, the organic marketplace hadn't been developed. And so we struggled the first couple years.
So why did you decide to go organic?
I thought it would be a way that worked for us on our land, because I thought if I'm going to farm this land, have family, and a turning point came when we had our first child in 1985, I thought this would be a better place for her to grow up in.
to some degree, you were a pioneer of this kind of farming. You didn't have as many role models as you might if you were doing this today, including you, because an awful lot of people read your books and go to your lectures because you have worked a lot of it out.
Yeah, thank you. And initially, it was a trial and error process where you're, you know, digging in old manuscripts, an old book I found, you know, that some farmer was trying these real radical, crazy things, and you go, oh, okay, let me see if I could trace that back to find what little tool or implement he used and if I could recreate it on our farm. So it was a lot of trial and error.
Your family had grown peaches before you started farming. Why peaches? Is that just the major crop in the area?
Well, peaches was a high-value crop that you could use family labor, all as an asset, and it would get shipped to market, and the better quality you took, the better you took care of it, usually the better price you got. So it was before the sort of commodification of tree fruit, and back then you could personalize it a lot and be rewarded for it.
Because I've only heard the names of three or four different kinds of peaches, Alberta peaches, Kling peaches, but you grow heirloom peaches. I don't know what that means exactly.
It's an older variety of peach that is no longer popular in the marketplace. All of our varieties have fantastic flavor. I'm not worried about the cosmetics. I'm not worried about the size, but I want that flavor, and hopefully, and we've been fortunate, we found homes for these peaches.
Where do peaches come from originally?
The highlands of China. So that's why they enjoy hot climate and hot weather like you're having today.
So when we go looking for heirloom tomatoes, we go to Mexico. When we look for heirloom potatoes, we go to the Andes. Did you have to go to China to find your heirloom peaches?
Not quite that far back. Peaches began actually with Marco Polo, began spreading throughout the world at that point, and different areas developed their own sort of peach varieties. Interesting thing about a lot of new varieties of peaches, new old varieties of peaches, I guess I could describe it that way. Peach trees sometimes grow a mutant limb that has a peach that's slightly different. Maybe it's a little earlier,
The same tree?
Exactly, and it's a mutation. That's where you get new varieties, because it's as if the peach is wanting to procreate in a slightly different way, maybe a slightly sweeter peach or something that has a more of a blush than a golden yellow, and we're looking for those, and that's how a lot of new varieties occurred.
Was your father growing heirlooms?
Heirlooms only because they were old peaches. We were poor farmers, so we tended to get our peaches from, like, for example, the USDA developed projects, as opposed to plant nurseries that had royalties and patents on new varieties.
Well, today you can sell all the heirloom produce you want to at green markets, but were the green markets for you to sell these things at then?
No. We sold into the conventional marketplace. So, in fact, we were penalized in the sense because our peaches weren't this beautiful red color peach. It's part of that legacy that family farms have often gone through, and that the battle that farmers have to work through.
So, and you say that other small farmers were doing the same sort of thing. They were all struggling in the same way. What advice would you give farmers about selling delicious yet harder to market fruits and vegetables nowadays?
One of the things today, and it's wonderful because of the internet and this new level of communication, follow your fruit to market. I mean, that's partly why I'm here in New York, because I wanted to see how some of the fruit was arriving, what chefs were working with it, and how they interacted with it. And it's part of that closure that is often missing with farmers, and that's why green markets, farmers markets have been so popular, and how things like a panel that I'm doing tomorrow afternoon at 92Y Tribeca talks about that legacy of farmers and the different generations and how they want to personalize the work that they do.
My guest is Mas Masumoto, whose latest book is Wisdom of the Last Farmer, Harvesting Legacies from the Land, with a foreword by Dan Barber, who's the executive chef and co-owner of Blue Hill Farms. The book is published by Free Press. You mentioned color. Now, color is really important, and the look of produce to buyers. But farmers keep on saying that shouldn't be a concern.
Well, it's interesting because I think we began to train ourselves to thinking of like a single color as being an indicator of maturity.
So red for the peach.
Red began to be adjusted to the idea that you had to be red to be good. And the reality is peaches come in all different colors. And what to me, you're looking for this golden color that a lot of the older varieties had. That was the indicator of when it was ripe, not just if it was red.
In New York, I tend to know about peaches as white peaches and yellow peaches.
Mm-hmm. White peaches were basically a peach that was grown that had what they call sub-acid, lower acid levels, so you don't taste, you taste the sugar more than the acid. I love yellow flesh that are balanced between the sugar and the acids because it's like a good wine in that sense.
And then there is the donut peaches.
Yes, the Saturn peaches, some of the galaxy peaches. And some of those were had their origins in China on that. And they're sort of a novelty peach more than anything, but they're fun.
They're expensive, and I don't understand it. You write that farming is in crisis. Really? Even though we're seeing so many people returning to farming?
If you look at the data and the numbers, the farms are still getting larger and larger. There is a blip in that small farms, very small farms. There's a little increase in it. But my concern is if you look at the majority of the how food is grown in the United States, there is this growing crisis of less farmers and larger operations.
And this is just the U.S.? Isn't there a global crisis?
It's exactly happening. It's the industrialization of our food system. And with that comes a lot of the pitfalls of industrialization.
I'm glad you said pits because you do grow a pit fruit. Part of the problem that farmers talk about is that it's costing them more to produce the product than they can get for it.
It's the economics of agriculture where we, especially recently, are in a cheap food policy system where everything is geared toward driving the prices down, irregardless of quality.
And when we talk about organic farming on the show, often listeners will say, well, organic food tastes more. Defenders of organic food say, well, you know, we actually subsidize cheap food, the food, and if we subsidize organic food, maybe it wouldn't be so expensive.
Well, I think people need to find where they find their value. And the main thing for me is value isn't always equated into dollars and cents. Buying a peach on sale for $1, $1.50 a pound, eating some and throwing away the rest is expensive versus paying a couple more dollars more for a good quality peach that you eat the whole thing.
You mentioned in the book that the average age of farmers in the U.S. today is 55 years old. How do you think we can encourage more young people to get into farming?
Well, I think one thing are shows like this, that people who are from non-farming backgrounds are gravitating toward agriculture, and I see that as renewal. One of the wonderful things in Wisdom of the Last Farmer that I write about is this theory, this idea of succession. And our daughter, who's 23 years old, is planning on taking over the farm. With that comes this whole generation that are interested in food, cooking, and also how to grow food, too.
And you even focus on some specific lessons here, like the value in a junk pile.
All good farms have a junk pile, but a wonderful way of describing it for me, and also in the story about, in Wisdom of the Last Farmer, is about my father's stroke. And the question is, does he become junk when he has his stroke? And we end up saying, no. This one farmer said, there are no such things as junk piles. It's all inventory.
You began the book with the story of your father's stroke. You and your daughter, Nikiko, had a workshop for young farmers yesterday at Stone Barns Center for Food and Agriculture. Do you see a shift happening where more and more young people are considering farming, at least becoming curious about it?
They're interested. They want to learn more. The challenges are the classic challenges of any business. Do they have the capital to start it? Are there markets for it? But there is that enthusiasm. And the nice things I saw in most of these young people, they knew they weren't going to get rich doing that. So when you come in with a lower expectation, maybe you're fulfilled more.
But it is also a really hard business because on top of everything else, you then have situations like we've had this year where we've had too much rain. Dan Barber, the chef at Blue Hills at Stone Barns, wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times recently about the blight that's devastating this year's tomato crop in the area. And now I don't know whether heirloom peaches are vulnerable to certain diseases, but I wonder, are heirloom varieties particularly susceptible to blights like that more than the kind that have been genetically engineered?
Some of the heirlooms actually have more resistance to diseases. So, for example, older peaches, varieties of peaches have a lot of fuzz. I think that creates a natural resistance. However, if you have torrential rains as I've understood you've had here, that are abnormal, it creates abnormal growing conditions and abnormal diseases. And it's tough. It's a shame, but that's part of nature and working with nature.
Does it also dilute the flavor of the fruit because there's just so much water going into the tree?
Plants like sunshine. I mean, like humans do, too. So if you had a lot of rain, you're probably kind of grumpy at harvest time, and I think that's what happened. I know it happens with peaches that way. If we have an off weather cycle, they're kind of grumpy, and you kind of have grumpy taste, and it's one of the realities of farming.
My guest has been David Masumoto, who is the award-winning author of Epitaph for a Peach and several other books. He's a columnist, a spokesperson for organic farming, and a fellow at the W.K. Kellogg Foundation. His latest book is called Wisdom of the Last Farmer, Harvesting Legacies from the Land, with a foreword by Dan Barber, and it's published by the Free Press. I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. A pleasure.